Welcome to episode 291 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. I'm your host, Ian Martin, and today we're going to be finding out all about Servaus Fis Ladis in the Tyrol region of Austria and how Swedish clothing brand Peak Performance designs their garments. We'll also learn about the new Chenu lift in Courchevel, plus we've got snow reports from around the Alps. But before we meet today's guests, I'd like to thank Tyrol in Austria for sponsoring the Ski Podcast and making this winter's episodes possible. If this is your first time listening, you have missed out on some great conversations already about Tyrol. We've covered Innsbruck, Ischgl, Tyrol West, Sanjahan in Tyrol, Ski Veld, Ski Jul, Zillertal areas so far. You can catch up with all of these, and I recommend you do. It's been so interesting finding out more about the Tyrol and the Lebensgefühl, that Austrian way of life that connects them all together. Now, let's meet today's guests. My first guest is freelance journalist Simon Miller. Hi, Simon. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Delighted to be here and looking forward to our chat.
Oh, and where are you today?
I am currently in the Three Valleys in France, specifically Saint-Martin-de-Belleville, and enjoying a few days skiing around this area.
Fantastic. I actually mentioned to you in the green room that my daughter is doing a season in the Three Valleys, and she was in Saint-Martin yesterday. And that led us to conversations. We took a family holiday in Lehman Weir many years ago. And that run, Jerusalem, I imagine you skied. It's just one of the most beautiful, spectacular and flattering runs in the Three Valleys, isn't it?
It's a great end of day run down into Saint-Martin-de-Belleville, really sort of long, rolling, bluey kind of ready run. I know it's famous, but yeah, enjoyed that like yesterday afternoon.
And my second guest today is Marie Anderson, ski designer at Peak Performance. Hi, Marie. How are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. It collides everything now because I actually have lived in Val Thorens for a season.
All right, I know you tend to get a lot of Swedes in Val Thorens. There's a big community there, and yeah. Such a great resort. Where are you today, though?
Today I'm in Stockholm, Sweden.
Okay, brilliant. So this is, I think, possibly the third podcast in a row where we've had all three of us across three different countries. And a question I do like to ask my guests, at the start of the show is, when did you ski or snowboard last? I think, Simon, you've probably given the game away. You're in a ski resort and you did tell us that you skied down to Saint Martin. But how are the conditions in the Three Valleys?
They're pretty good. We have had a couple of days of blue sky skiing. There was a very large dump of snow last week. And then, unfortunately, it's sort of the temperature rose a little bit. So the off-piste is, you definitely need a guide to find the really good off-piste. But the pistes are in great condition. I think it's due to cloud in a little bit, and maybe there's snow forecast next week.
I'm very jealous that you are going to be going out skiing this afternoon. Marie, you mentioned you've done a season in the Belleville Valley in Val Thorens. When were you last on snow yourself, though?
Last year in the Dolomites. And I had a lovely week with a lot of snow and amazing food and company. Next week, I'm going to Åre, which is our kind of hometown.
Oh, and whereabouts were you in the Dolomites last year?
Val Gardena. We stayed there, but then we, skied all the, the Sella Ronda.
Well, regular guests will remember, I was actually out in Val Gardena myself last winter, and it was my first time in the Dolomites. Incredible ski area. Simon's in the Three Valleys at the moment. And I actually was so impressed with the Dolomites and the Sella Ronda with the scale of the area. And I think what it does have over the Three Valleys is it is just so beautiful. I hope you had some sunny days when you were there. Just stunning, isn't it?
It was so nice because it was not so much people and still fresh and cold snow, which, yeah, we were lucky.
Oh, and you said that you're going skiing shortly to Åre, which for British listeners is kind of like pronounced A-R-E-R. How far is that from Stockholm?
It is quite far, actually. Probably an 8-hour drive because Sweden is so, long. we're going to take the train, though, the night train. So I will sleep the 8-hour.
Oh, well, you know, that always gets me very excited. Everyone knows I love to travel by train. I'll be taking a night train actually myself when I go to Isla 2000. Next month, I'm going on the Paris to Nice overnight train. Cool. I've got lots of questions really about Aura. Do you know what the snow's like this winter?
Started quite slow, like not so much snow, but now it's catching up. And at the moment, I think it's very cold though. It can be super cold, but I think the snow coverage is quite okay. But it's been a sketchy pre-season.
Okay. Well, Simon mentioned that Europe in general, it was a pretty dry December in the Alps, but there was a big snowfall in early January. And that's been snow again since then, but there is more coming in. Let's have a listen to what conditions are like on the ground from some of our regular snow reporters. We've got Andy Butterworth from Kaluma Travel reporting from St. Anton in Austria. James from Sausy Online in Sausidu in the Milky Way ski area of Italy. And Chris from Freeride Republic reports from Mirabel, just over the valley from Simon.
Hi everyone, it's Andy over in St. Anton. Hope everyone is well and Happy New Year to everyone. 2026 has brought about a little bit of everything over in St. Anton and around the Arlberg. It started where the slopes were getting a little bit green, but thanks to the amazing snow cannons, it kept skiing all the way back to the town where everyone else was struggling. St. Anton was doing really, really well. We then had a biblical dump of snow where in resort at 1300 metres it put down about 70 centimetres in resort in about 48 hours, which resulted in over a metre and a half up at the top. So now there's a base at the top of Valuga of way over 2.5 metres, which is absolutely fantastic for this time of year. It was powder skiing, it was cold, it was fantastically fluffy. Then, sadly, it warmed up, the warm winds came in, and down in resort it was raining. Which wasn't the best result after such great snow, but it kept the piece in superb condition. It compressed the snow down and it went back to being cold, like minus 14, 15, 16 overnight, which kept everything solid and frozen. I've just had a wonderful ski day. Finished up with runs from top to bottom, Valuga all the way down. The slopes are in incredible condition. It was a blue sky day. And there's even a little bit of fresh powder still to be found off the piece. Forecast snow isn't great, but temperatures staying cold and weather is going to be blue skies and fresh, which is great to keeping the slopes in such fantastic condition. Thanks, guys.
Hello, Ian. This is James from Sausy Online. Today I'm reporting from the resort of Bardonecchia, which technically isn't in the Via Lattea, but it is included on a 6-day pass. So I am skiing on my own, unfortunately, today because Sinead is a little bit under the weather. But unlike Sinead, the skiing is absolutely tip-top. On Friday of last week, we had a weather system that came in again from the Mediterranean. That's the third time we've had a weather system that's come in from that direction. And it delivered about 40 centimetres of fresh snow. Today, it's clear blue skies. There is not a cloud in the sky. The trees are laden with snow. We've got lovely squeaky snow on piste. The off-piste conditions are looking promising, but there are high avalanche risks in the area. So just stick to skiing on the piste because the piste conditions are fantastic. We do have another weather system that's coming in on Friday. Again, it's promising. Well, not quite as much as last week, but we should be in for about 10, 15 centimetres of snow again on Friday stroke Saturday. So all in all, it is shaping up to be a fantastic season. Certainly January so far has been great here in the Via Lattea. So if you're thinking of booking a last minute holiday, then look no further. We have some fantastic skiing on offer. So that's it. That's a quick roundup from Bardonecchia stroke the Via Lattea. I hope the shoulder's mending well, Ian, and we'll catch you on the next one. Cheers.
I'm Chris, and this is the Freeride Republic Snow Report from Mirabel, your rider-led intel for the week ahead. Over the last few days, we've enjoyed a return to mostly sunny and mild conditions. Snowpack depths are considered normal for this time of year, but a persistent weak layer is making life difficult for those wishing to venture off-piste. On-piste, it's a different story, with all lists running and 67 out of 72 pistes open, with super grippy snow, ideal for those who love to carve. Off-piste, the snowpack is taking time to stabilise, especially on steep, cold slopes. We've backed away from a number of lines this week after conducting our own propagation tests. Looking ahead, we have more snow on the way over the weekend, perhaps as much as 20 centimetres, so if you're driving to Maribel, pack your snow chains and keep an eye on the weather forecast. All that snow is coming in on high winds that may also close the Three Valley connections for a time. Temperatures are set to drop again, perhaps as low as minus 15, and it will feel colder still in the wind. The good news is that Monday is looking like it could be a bluebird powder day, so plan for an early start and first chair up the mountain. With new wind-affected snow incoming, we think the avalanche danger scale is likely to rise again. Be sure to check the daily bulletins before planning any off-piste adventures. When the weather closes in, we think the best place to be is in the trees, and Maribel has many awesome tree-lined runs. For peace skiers, our current favourite is Mordwy, below the Solier midstation. For those of an off-piste persuasion, consider laps on the Adrae chairlift, which offers access to fantastic powder skiing after fresh snow. For more mountain intel, head to freeriderepublic.com. Ride safe, ride kind.
Right. Just before we talk about the Olympics, a quick note on the numbering of the podcast. I've had several messages from listeners asking why we have over 280 episodes, but the latest episode number is only 270-something. Well, that's actually because of all the equipment specials we've had. And to make it more clear, I'm introducing a new taxonomy from today. We have 291 episodes available. So this is episode 291, and I'll keep it like that from now on too, so everyone understands where we are. So we now have 2 weeks to go until the Winter Olympics in Milan Cortina. Excitement is mounting. Once again, start, we will be covering all the major stories here on the Ski Podcast. Right now, we're focusing on Team GB, as the majority of our listeners are based in the UK. Now, this episode is going live on Friday, the 23rd of January. And later today, we're recording at 7 a.m. at the moment, the official team will be announced. But this week, I've had the chance to speak with different members of the team, and I'm going to be sharing those interviews as we get closer to the Games. As I mentioned, they start on the 6th of February in 2 weeks' time. Not so much to report from British team members in the last week or so. However, the X Games starts today in America. It'll be very interesting to see how our top freestyle athletes get on. We've got Zoe Atkin, Mia Brooks, Kirsty Muir all out there, as well as Gus Kenworthy as well. So that will be top level competition and a great primer for the Olympics coming up. However, for the moment, we're going to move on to Austria and to the Tyrol. I mentioned that today we're going to be talking about Surfaus Fis Lardis. Those are three towns. We're going to find out more about them from Simon, because you were out there last month, I think. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I was there 15th to the 21st of December with my two of my daughters, and we had a great time.
Cool. Whereabouts were you staying then? Because that is Surfaus Fis Lardis, three different villages that are all connected, right?
That's right. We were staying in Surfaus, which is the largest of the three villages, and in a hotel called Hotel Servosa, which I can thoroughly recommend. It's a very nice luxury five-star hotel with all of the trimmings. So it was one of those holidays where you need to ski hard to work off the calories that you consume at dinner.
Yeah, well, I think everyone would love staying in a five-star hotel. But I think one of the things that stands out about the area is that Surfaus itself is pretty high in terms of the resort level itself, right?
Yeah, it is. I think it's about sort of 1,200 metres. Maybe so, the three villages are all roughly at the same level, between 1,200 and 1,300. The top lift in Surfaus, in the Masna region of the resort, so the sort of the far end of the valley, tops out at 2,828, I think. And then there are a series of lifts along the ridge, which roughly 2,500. There's plenty of snow when we were there, and obviously height is part of that story.
Sure. And you mentioned you were there with your family. Do you mind me asking, how old are your kids?
Yeah, so my eldest daughter, 19, and my youngest is 15. He says, making sure he gets it right. We had a wonderful time. Good fun skiing and very enjoyable.
Okay, so there we're talking about like teams. I think Surfaus Fis Lardis in general positions themselves really specifically as a family destination. Did that come across to you? I know your children are a little bit older, but did you see that while you were there?
I absolutely did. It's really interesting, actually. Their sort of their strap line is "We are family." And there are lots of things sort of sprinkled throughout the entire resort which reflect that. And you know, some really small things that they do, and some more sort of strategically big things. Perhaps starting with a more sort of general point is that there's a sort of a sense of people being quite respectful on the mountains. I don't mean to say that people ski recklessly in other places, but when you're skiing in some of the perhaps more famous resorts where there are a lot of extremely good skiers, people doing their season in their sort of early 20s, late teens, then, you know, they've all got those Avo packs on that they've sort of really sort of kitted out. And you know, I've never had a problem, but there's a sense of you're skiing in a place with a lot of very, very good skiers. And just the mood, the general sort of sentiment on the mountain in South Aus-Fisladis was, I think, just a shade more relaxed. It's a bit difficult to quantify it, but I think there's that sense in the lift where there's a sort of a wider range of ages, perhaps. You can tell by, you know, the people are skiing. There's a sort of more average standard of skiing across the piece. And I noticed it when you're on that sort of run down to the valley, you didn't have people sort of coming herring past you, sort of racing down to sort of valley level. There was a sort of almost an orderly queue being formed that everybody's skiing at sort of, I don't know, whatever speed it was, giving each other a wide berth. So there's a real sense of that coming across. And then there were all sorts of other things which I think sort of link the family, and perhaps one which is a little bit unski related, but years and years ago, I think over 20 years ago, the town invested in what they claim to be the shortest and highest underground rail system. So there's four stops that go from the car park, stopping twice in town and ending up at the lift. And for kids, they can put themselves forward to be the sort of the train attendant for the day. So, you know, there'll be Hugo from Stockholm doing all the announcements for the stops and wishing everybody a great day. And there's a picture of him in the control room. I'm sure if I was 7 years old, then the thing I would go and tell my friends after a ski holiday was the fact that I was the train driver for the day, as well as obviously all the great skiing.
That is very cool. I had read about the subway there, the only ski resort subway, let's say. So it's four stops, is it?
Yeah, four stops. And it's very regular. I mean, I think, you know, we worked it out that we could walk from the bottom lift to our hotel in about 15 minutes, but it was just sort of sometimes more convenient to take the train. And particularly if you're, you know, this has got to the family point, if you're sort of manhandling two, three kids or whatever it is, then, you know, you're not carrying a quiver of skis and poles and all the equipment, and just let the train do a bit more of the work for you is, I think, a really nice touch. And the sort of the forward thinking and planning to sort of build that, the investment in, then carries through with a lot of the other things that they've done. It's not just a sort of a one thing they've done and then that's it. It's sort of reflected in a lot of other things that South Aus-Fisladis has sort of done to make it more convenient for families, I think.
Oh, and with a train, I'm kind of visualizing it being like, you know, let's say you might often get on a train in a ski resort, but it's normally funicular.
Yeah, I mean, it's regular tube. I mean, I'm from London. It's a tube train, you know, and it's very easy to access. It's not sort of super deep. It's very quick and convenient to use.
Very interesting what you said there about the how you felt safe on the slopes, because the conversation that we've had through the last kind of three episodes now is about safe skiing. We had Nicole Feliciano from Ski Moms in the States, who's started the slow skiing movement and the Slow Skiers Club. And then we followed that up with a conversation in Val d'Isère. They have introduced a ski tranquille, these zones where they are set aside for people to be able to feel safer. I sensed, Simon, when you were talking about the people skiing around fast with their Avo packs on and things like this, that they were possibly Swedish seasonaires up in Valterens who've been whizzing past you.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've all done that kind of skiing and, you know, by and large, everything's fine. But I think that, you know, it's that sort of general sense of being surrounded by people who are, as I say, giving each other a bit of a wide berth, not sort of, you know, going past at sort of massive speed, was definitely evident in Serfaus. And I enjoyed it for that.
And, you know, your kids are kind of older teens then. So the ski area itself, if I was with my kids around that age, you know, they're probably decent skiers. They go out with you. Was there a sufficient ski area to cover while you were there?
It is massive, deceptively large. You know, there are 214 kilometres of skiing and I think 68 lifts if you look on the website. But I think what is also sort of hidden by that. So firstly, 214 kilometres is pretty big already. But because, as we've said before, it's spread out over three villages, there's actually a lot of space between the runs. And so, you know, if you're blessed with good off-piste, you've got a vast terrain to ski. And there's sort of a little, I really oughtn't to publicize this, but the fact is that if you go and ski in a resort where there aren't sort of 1,001 Swedish saisonniers there, and there's a good dump of snow, then you've got days to find fresh tracks, whereas, you know, you'll be hard pressed to get that fresh track after 11 o'clock on a big ski day in resorts where there are lots and lots of those kind of skiers. When we were there, actually, we had great on-piste conditions and a testament to the snowmaking in many Austrian resorts, and Saalfahrtsfestlandet definitely delivers on that. But we were actually restricted to the piste. Just, you know, we weren't there on a week that was great off-piste skiing. But I looked with envy at the sort of the vastness of the terrain. Sometimes you think, oh, it's a family-oriented resort. It's going to be, you know, cartoon characters and green runs everywhere. There are cartoon characters and plenty of nice, easy runs and good beginner areas. But there's plenty to keep anybody who's a sort of a very, very good skier more than interested. Huge areas of off-piste. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to take advantage of that, but looked with envy at these fields, which I knew would be covered in deep snow shortly.
Oh, I do like that insight. You know, quite often we talk about different resorts that maybe people wouldn't necessarily consider as an advanced skier because they don't get skied out as quickly. And whenever I mention them on the podcast, people say, no, shh. Don't tell people about this. You know, I'm going to say it now, but a classic is Les Contamines. You know, just around the corner from Chamonix, I know lots of people who live in Chamonix who go off and ski in Les Contamines because the powder there can still be there days after a fresh snowfall. However, just back to Saalfahrtsfestlandet, did you do any non-ski activities? Because something that seems to have come across from the conversations about Tyrol, you know, there's a lot going on off the piste as well.
Yeah, we did. We went to a really amazing sort of night show. You go all the way up to, I think it's a sort of the mid station at sort of 2000 meters. So get the lift up at 6-7 sort of after dinner type of time. And then they put on this sort of multi magic color show with, sure, there's a ski displays and there's aerials being done, but there's a drone display, there's fireworks, there's a sort of a music theme throughout it. There's a live band playing. You know, they were saying that they regularly get 2,500 people watching that every week. I think it's on a Wednesday, starts at about 8 or 9 o'clock, shifts slightly in time, I think, throughout the season around 9 o'clock and then maybe later in the season. But, you know, again, that's a sort of a big investment. And again, sort of there was a lot of different people up there enjoying it. And, you know, the kids seemed excited by seeing people pulling all sorts of aerial stunts and the drone display. That was just was fantastic. So something for everybody, I think, would the marketing people would tell you. And then we did, you know, Austria is famous for its toboggan runs as well. And sure enough, Saalfahrtsfestlandet has got sort of ample options for toboggan runs where it's really well organized, well groomed, properly set up and safe away from skiers, but again, through the trees and just sort of lovely doing the toboggan runs.
And something else that everybody has talked about in terms of the Tyrol, and I actually had the chance to experience myself in St. Anton, are the mountain restaurants and some of the local dishes. I can't believe I got to my age before I had my first Kaiserschmarrn, which was in St. Anton last month. Did you try any of the mountain restaurants?
Yeah, we did. I mean, I mentioned the hotel that we were staying in, which was truly amazing. So given the volume of food we were eating there, we kept lunches to relatively minimal, but nevertheless stopped in a places and had the infamous Kaiserschmarrn. And genuinely one of the best I've ever had was at the Schalbealm, which is at the top of the, just at the mid station in Saalfahrtsfestlandet itself. The other place that I think is really worthy of note is a place called the Skihutta Masnar. Masner is the region at, if you like, the far end of Saufaus, where the there's a sort of a, almost a bowl with two or three lifts all the way up to sort of 2008, as I mentioned before. And at the base, there are a couple of restaurants, including the Skihutta Masnar, with very, very good quality food, extremely efficient. I mean, you know, just the number of people that they can handle on a sort of over lunch and is tremendous. And notable also for absolutely enormous windows, providing just a beautiful view down the valley. So, and then next door, there is, I think, a little bit more of an a la carte restaurant for those wanting to have, you know, that sort of different dining experience. But, you know, we stopped in a few places and were impressed by all of them.
That's great, Simon. I'll definitely make sure that we put a link into the show notes for those two places. Can I, a couple of basics, actually, I probably should have tackled earlier. I guess I'm going to know the answer. We're talking about the Tyrol. Did he fly into Innsbruck?
Yeah, we flew into Innsbruck. And for those who know the region, you can either, you know, drive. It's about an hour and 20 minutes from Innsbruck to Saufaus. There is a train that you can get from Innsbruck main station. You then get to Landeck, and at Landeck, that's where the road peels off in one direction to St. Anton. I think the next road goes up to Ischgl, and then the next one is the one to Saufaus. And so I think you get a regional bus from Landeck up to Saufaus. So you can do it all on public transport. Super easy to get to, quite frankly. And I think that's why it's hugely popular amongst Germans, Austrians, huge number of Dutch people, but genuinely precious few Brits, as far as I could make out. Clearly, I wasn't surveying, you know, academically every single skier, but just in terms of the number of British accents I heard, relatively few.
Probably a lot of our listeners, that would actually be a big selling point as well. So you were there with two kind of older teams. We mentioned it is a resort for families as well. What about the kind of après ski side of things? Does it work for that as well?
It does. I think, you know, a lot of Austrian resorts make a big thing about their sort of their party scene. And we all know about, you know, the Musavirt and various other places on the run into St. Anton. I think there are some mountain bars which open late, but they're relatively small on the mountain in Saufaus. But down in town, there is the Patchy Bar, which, as somebody who's perhaps not in their mid-20s, when I opened the door and saw sort of the tables full of people dancing on the tables and drinking beer, there was clearly a very big party scene going on. So the Patchy Bar is the place for that sort of event. And then a little bit more sort of tranquil, but nevertheless, I thought wonderful bars, a place called George's Bar in the middle of town, run and DJ'd by George, who I had a good chat with, but a really good après ski bar. And there's plenty of others, but those are two that give Saufaus certainly, you know, you're not going to be short of some nightlife, put it that way.
Oh, it sounds excellent. And I haven't been there. I've been to lots of the resorts in the Tyrol, but that is another one to add to my list. That is brilliant, Simon. Thank you so much for that. I think that you have an article coming out about that trip soon in City AM. So when that does come out, I'll share that via our social networks. Right. If it's okay, I'm going to just swing over to France now, because as regular listeners will know, I was out in Courchevel earlier this month. And while my current injury means I wasn't skiing, I was able to try out their impressive new Chenu gondola. And afterwards, I spoke with Philippe Mottier, general manager of S3V, the Courchevel lift company, about the project. We spoke in French, but for the benefit of the podcast listeners, Marion Guillemot from the tourist office kindly translated for us. Let's have a listen to that conversation. I'm here in Courchevel with Philippe Mottier, who is in charge of the lift system in Courchevel for S3V. Bonjour, Philippe.
Bonjour.
Ça va?
Très bien.
It's been a very snowy last 24 hours, so I appreciate you finding the time to talk to me today. I'm going to be asking a couple of questions about the new lift. You know, regular listeners will know that I spoke back in episode 229 with Laundrie Tirard about the Celia cable car, but we're now talking about the Chenu, a new telecabine gondola, as we were talking in English. I know the original one opened in 1970, but this project has taken quite some time. You know, when did the work start for this?
Donc le projet du remplacement de l'ancien.
The first one that came out in 1969 was first for 4 place people, and then the project started when three years ago.
So the new lift, we're sitting looking at it now. It's got like next generation bubbles. I read there are 54 gondolas. There are only 11 pylons where there were, 15 before. The speed is much quicker. You got the 2,400 skiers per hour. It's a better location. Can I ask why the lift was relocated to that position?
Sure.
Alors, on a volontairement sorti la gare du bâtiment.
So they relocated the gondolas because it was not very easy to access for all the people, and especially it has been relocated for people to go up and then go down and take it again to go up multiple times on the La Luz Massif.
Okay, and I was really interested to find out about some of the sustainability elements of it. For example, read that there are solar panels on the new lift, and there's a system of water collection as well, and also that the old lift was recycled. What has happened to the old lift?
They tried their best to use like most ecological things to like take part of the sustainability of the resort and keep it like a very natural place. So they keep some ways to go through the forest to not cut trees as much as they can. That's why you have less pylons, because they wanted to protect all the like the flora and the animals that are over there and needs to be protected.
Et de la même manière, les clients peuvent se demander ce que c'est.
Some system on the cable that like alarms the birds to like tell them when there is no gondola that they can cross the cable.
Am I right in understanding then that there was a chairlift and a gondola which have both been taken out?
26 pylons for the total.
So 26 pylons taken away and only 11 put back.
Yeah.
In relation to, I think I asked a question, the old lift was recycled. What does that mean? What happened to the old lift?
Alors, quand on a récupéré et revendu les anciennes cabines.
So all the old gondolas were sold in a special sales. And what is great is that they think about what they're going to do with the money. And the money is going to be donated to association who has the same purpose as them, as to protect the mountains.
Cool. Yeah. That's great. I didn't know that. I do know that the gondolas were auctioned. I remember that now.
Yeah. So all the materials were given to special society for them to reuse it, such as the wood, for example. And for the chairlifts, the SRV keep them because they know that they can reuse them on some of the other system of the mountain that we have in Courchevel.
Cool. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. You want to use all of the materials where possible. Well, it's certainly a very impressive lift. And you mentioned earlier that the main access is Col de la Luz, where you can get access through to Mirabel. But it's also possible from the top there to go down towards, let's say, La Tania, or to take L'Eclipse, the famous downhill run that was used in the World Championships and may be used in the Olympic Games as well, right? We're waiting for confirmation of that, I understand, right?
Yeah.
Also, though, I think, the lift is really good because, sadly, I'm not skiing, but it's good if you're a pedestrian, a piéton as well, because from that top level, and maybe more in summer, but there's several restaurants up there, right?
Mais surtout, l'accès piéton, au-delà de l'accès restaurant, ça permet d'accéder à...
But yeah, the pedestrians can also go, and it's very helpful for them to know that they can go up to the Col de la Luz, and I mean, you have a wonderful view over there.
Yeah.
And you also have the cross-country slopes over there.
That's fantastic. Merci, Philippe, pour tout ça. Et aussi, merci. Thank you, Marion, for doing the translations. That's really useful. Thanks so much for your time. I'll let you get back on with your day. If you'd like to know more about the Chenu Lift, I wrote an article for We Love to Ski about that. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. Now, we're going to turn to Marie now. Although I couldn't ski when I was in Courchevel, I was wearing a Peak Performance jacket while I was there. I am a huge fan of Peak Performance. I've been wearing one or other of your jackets for years now. One of the reasons we have you on the show is you are a designer. How did you get into design itself?
It's two parts kind of that crossed. As a kid, I was very creative. Like, I loved to paint, to do all the creative stuff. And also, I always loved ideas. Like, it can be anything. Like, love a good idea. And I love to come up with ideas. And the other part is that I competed in skiing when I was young, in alpine skiing. And lived in Chamonix for many, many years. And I kind of wanted to merge what I love. So that's why I actually entered or applied for design school.
Oh, I feel that my research is remiss. I should know more about that side of your skiing. You said you worked a season in Velterenz, but were you skiing like on the Free Ride World Tour or doing free ride events?
Yeah, but more like the Nordic Championship.
Fantastic. So you transitioned, you know, from being an incredibly keen and talented skier into design. How long have you been at Peak Performance?
I've been at Peak Performance for almost 5 years now.
Oh, and the company itself was founded in 1986 and it is a Swedish company. Is this the job that every designer in Sweden would love to have, to be working for Peak Performance?
Yeah, it is a very desirable workplace because we also merge fashion and functionality technology, then it's very desirable.
Sure, and I know that you are officially designer for ski and golf. Obviously, I'd like to focus on ski. I don't know if this is purely Scandinavian obsession, but quality and aesthetics is something that Peak Performance are very focused on. How does a process of design work?
Normally, we kind of have our responsibilities, and I've been together with another person. We have been responsible together for the ski collection, and we've been working like men and women, but now we more like work with family thinking. So, if, for example, if we're going to make a new family, I do both men and women. It's a very living process, and as we work as designers, from outer layer, mid layer, base layer, you know, the whole shebang.
What is the lead time for that? Because often, you know, we have Al Morgan, our equipment expert, on, and he tries the different equipment, whether it's hardware or soft goods, I'm going to say years before they hit the market, but certainly a long way in advance. So what is the lead time for the type of products that you're working on?
Approximately 18 months, because now I'm delivering the last sketches for fall winter 27, 2 years kind of ahead.
That's amazing, really. I guess you have to be a patient person for that, to wait to see for your products to get to market and see how they go down. But I think you do get feedback, because I think Congratulations are in order as one of your products. Specifically, the R&D Helium Loop Anorak recently won an award at ISPO. I wondered actually first if you could just explain to our listeners, because they wouldn't necessarily know what ISPO is.
ISPO is one of the world's largest winter sports fair in Munich. It's also, there is a version in China as well. It's where the whole industry comes together, and also like buyers from stores, brands, marketing people, designers, product developers. So that's the big where we meet.
So you've worked on your product for a long time. You've developed it, you created it, and then this is the first opportunity to get some outside feedback on it. And evidently, the Helium Loop Anorak went down very well. I wondered if you could just tell us what makes the Helium Loop so special.
The whole thing is that we got together. We are four collaborators. So it's not only a Peak Performance-driven kind of innovation. It's a concept that the collaboration across the industry is necessary to move the needle when it comes to circularity and how to be more sustainable in this business. We have used this dissolvable thread from Resortex that makes it possible to recycle the down. So if you put it into this machine, it dissolves the thread. Because the difficulties with the down is it's very complex because it's hard to trace it. And it's very time consuming and expensive because you have to make down in channels. So now when this, it's kind of, it goes into a silo, the down. So it makes it much more easy to recycle it. Also, this was a proof of concept. The journey just started, you can say.
It's interesting you say the journey has only just started because I read that it will never be completed. What does that mean?
But this is where the beauty of that we are working together in the industry, the garment, like the we who design and produce the garments, the thread company, Allied Feather, who makes the down, and the fabric suppliers, Nextplus and Pertex, where we all come together to create the need also for shaping how to work with recycling and scalability and take-back system.
I find it extremely interesting. I know Peak Performance has always been very focused on sustainability. I was actually reading the sustainability report last year, and I see there's a goal of net zero by 2050. Focus on longevity. You mentioned the circularity side of things there, but also upcycling and end of use. And I was interested to read, I think, in that report about the helium flow and the flow concept, because does that sound for fabric leftovers flow?
Yes, correct. Yeah, it's when you make garments, like sometimes things goes, you know, maybe you one color that doesn't, you know, survive the all the gate, or there is fabrics that are not used because it's maybe you order more than you need, or it's, you know, also since we're working with these long lead times, it's always hard to predict how much or how little you should produce. So there will be a leftover kind of issue. So we decided to use it, like even if it's like the colors from the past. It's also like a collaboration with the factory. It's a game to play, kind of.
Yeah, I was going to say it's almost like a maths equation as well, because presumably you only have, you know, the leftovers in certain sizes. So in terms of the design, you have to work out how you're going to be able to incorporate those in products like the helium flow or the vertical pro flow. That's a shell made from surplus fabrics. So, I mean, that is really a challenge, I think, for you as a designer. You obviously, you know, enjoy being a creative, but trying to work out how you can build products like that. Yeah. It's a new type of challenge that's coming with that goal towards sustainability.
It's also like a super beautiful story with how you can not throw away things. You use what you have. And as we did with the helium loop, like we only had what we used the four ingredients in the anorak. Like we didn't add anything. So this is kind of, it's a beautiful thing to use what we have, kind of.
For sure. I mentioned earlier that I've been using Peak Performance jackets for quite a long time. I actually upgraded my old insulated jacket to a shell jacket, the Vizlite. I happen to have it here. I'm going to hold it up for the camera, but it won't work for you listeners. But sadly, I only got to use it for 2 days, you know, in action before I actually fractured my scapula. I don't know if you know that. Last month when I was in St. Anton. I'm hoping to get out and try it again properly next month. But were you involved in the design of my jacket?
I do the colouring of that. That is actually designed, it is designed many, many years ago, actually, as a ski touring jacket, a 365, like hiking and skiing. It's been a part more of the hiking collection, kind of. Yeah. So it's my style, but I'm not the founder.
Cool. Well, the colorways are fantastic. That was one of the reasons I picked it. But also for the touring side of things, you know, the insulated jacket I had before, it was great. And it worked for me. And I do, you know, quite a bit of touring. But I decided, look, you know, this is a time. I'd had it for quite a long time. It was still in good condition. And actually, this is good and true. I sold it on eBay recently. So it's been, you know, recycled onto someone else to use. So in terms of longevity, it's going on. But yeah, I felt this was more appropriate for my ski touring, and it all goes well. I'm going out to Chamonix in March for a couple of months. So I plan to do a lot of ski touring there. That is brilliant, Marie. Thank you so much for that. And congratulations again on the ISPO award. I'm going to put links to all those products in the show notes. We're just going to move towards the close now. If you've enjoyed this episode, or even if you didn't like it, I would love to know. You can leave a comment on Spotify, Instagram, or Facebook. Our handle is @theskipodcast, or you can drop me an email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of each podcast. You can look in the show notes for that link. I have had some feedback since the last episode. Lara Rosenbaum said, I hope you're feeling better after your fracture. That is very kind of you, Lara. I admire your spirit and I love the podcast. Claire Harrison, now I mentioned her last week. She asked a question about the Zillertal, which we answered on the podcast. She said, a great piece on the Zillertal, thank you. Particularly looking forward to the Tyrolean cuisine on our trip. Thank you for a great podcast. It's endlessly interesting. She also mentions she loved episode 267 on gloves and socks and bought a pair of the level gloves on Al's recommendation. Ed Hopkins said, I absolutely loved episode 270 on St. Anton and Lech and sustainability and slow skiing, which I mentioned earlier. So interesting, and I learned a lot. And Ross on Twitter said, I just discovered the ski podcast, really enjoyed the insights on snow sports. There are now 291 episodes of the ski podcast to catch up with, as I clarified earlier. And remarkably, every single one of those previous episodes was listened to in the last week. Now, that normally means someone has been making their way through our back catalogue, and you can do that too. If you'd like to find out more about a particular destination, would like to listen to an interview with an athlete or get advice on what kit to buy, just go to skipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something that will tick that box. I can also tell you in the last week, slightly more than half of our listeners were in the UK, 24% in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as Zambia, Kazakhstan, and China. If you'd like to help the podcast, there are three things you can do. You can follow us or subscribe. You can give us a review on Apple Podcasts, leave us a comment on Spotify. And if you're booking ski hire this winter, don't forget, you can get an additional discount if you use code SKIPODCAST when you book at intersportrent.com, or simply take a link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied. Right. For now, I would like to thank my guest today, Marie Tuck.
Tack så mycket.
And Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I would like to thank Tyrol for sponsoring the podcast. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.